Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. It's Sunday the 10th of March. I'm Phil Carroll.
And I'm Kevin Horst.
We're coming to you from London, where we've attended the Master Investor Show at the Business Design Centre. More on that later. You'll hear from some of the people we've met. So how's your week been, Kev? I know it's been a bit of a whirlwind for you. You've been travelling all over the place, and then you've been obviously back into London. You were in Namibia. Your wife's been away. How's things been going over there?
Yeah, I've been good. I was at the Red Sea there over the weekend with the kids. As you say, my wife was away in South Africa on some adventure that she was on, and then she came back and, yeah, was working away. And then I flew to London on Thursday, and so far I've eaten two curries and a Chinese. We're only 2 days in, so your soup diet's gone out the window.
Okay, so you've swapped one soup diet for effectively a curry diet, and we're still very similar sauces, isn't it? Just a little bit of spice.
and a lot of fat.
A lot of meat. You've had a bit of dal, you've had a bit of lentils made today, so you're doing all right.
And no, I had seafood, I had some prawns, and I had the other seafood, which is seafood and eat it, which basically is what I've most of the yesterday and today. I did appease myself with the only fruit for breakfast, so I had raspberries and pineapple for breakfast, so
yeah,
that was very good. But yeah, back in the big smoke, it's been interesting. We've had some great meetings with some brokers, some other PR companies, so yeah, it's been really good. And now we're at the Master Investors, and there's some interesting stuff that we'll fill you in as we go through the podcast.
Yeah, so I mean, let's have a look at some of the news this week. There was obviously really only one story that dominated the news, and that was obviously news of the spring budget. I mean, was it any good? I suppose, you know, will it help the Tories in the long run? Maybe. There's potentially more stealth taxes in the form of 3.2 million low-income earners paying income tax from next year, and another 2.1 million paying tax at the higher 40% rather than 20%. So that one was the sort of the headline news that really didn't make headline news, because it was, as I say, a stealth tax, the thing that they didn't mention. NI cuts, obviously, that we saw the 2p, or the 2p cut from the 10p. Freeze on fuel and alcohol duty. And the big one for investors is the government announcing the introduction of a new British ISA to encourage investment in UK companies and boost the city. Obviously, it'll give people an additional £5,000 tax-free allowance to invest in UK assets on top of the existing £20,000 limit. This will be on top of the existing ISA allowances and ensure that British savers can benefit from the growth of the most promising UK businesses, as well as supporting them with the capital to help them expand, the Chancellor Jeremy Hunt said in his budget. And Mr. Hunt also said he had received calls from the city representatives to reform the ISA system and encourage more people to invest in UK assets. It forms part of plans to revive the UK stock market, which has faced an exodus of companies and a dearth of new listings in London. The British ISA will apply to people who max out their £20,000 tax-free allowance on an ISA. Will it help, do you think?
Tiny bit. It didn't go far enough, as far as I'm concerned. It should have been. It shouldn't have even been an additional allowance, as far as I was concerned. It should have been £20,000 and a minimum of 25% of whatever you put into an ISA has to be invested in UK companies, up to a maximum or minimum.
How would you enforce that? So that seems almost, from an administrative point of view, wouldn't that be difficult to sort of enforce and to?
Yeah, maybe it would be, but I'm just practically speaking about what should be done. Yeah. If you know what I mean. I mean, and you may well be right. The administration side of that might be just impossible, if you like. So maybe it was 15 grand and another 5 grand could be invested for the 5,000 in ISA. Anyway, we needed £5,000 of everybody's ISA invested in UK companies. That's my belief. And because we need the economy to do better. If we want to have a UK-centric business and UK businesses supported by the UK, public, that's what we need to do. The other thing that was in the budget was the announcement of vape taxes.
Yep.
And obviously an increase in the cigarette levy as well, or cigarette tax. I mean, I think it's going to be £20 before we know it for a packet of cigarettes. Yeah. But interestingly, they said the ban for disposable vapes would not come into effect until April next year at the earliest. April, is that when they start the 6 months, or is that before that? You'd have to think that's when they start the 6 months. So we could be talking towards the end of 2025 before it actually happens. And the vape tax isn't going to come in until April 2026. So this is something that really does affect the chill brands. It's been absolutely battered because everybody's had an element of uncertainty. And now there still is uncertainty, but the reality is it's miles away, you know, in terms of when all these things are going to come into place. And before they come into place, there's going to be pod systems and, you know, all sorts of things that aren't disposable anymore from all the companies, I think, to be honest, not just Chill. But, you know, Chill Zero is a brand. It's out there. It's in many places, and it's selling on a regular basis. And the company's never had as much revenue as it possibly has. I think I was speaking to somebody, I think it was on Thursday, when I met somebody here, a broker it was in London. And he said to me, and it really struck home to me, he says, Chill Brands has never been in a better position in the last 3 or 4 years than it is right now. And probably it's at its lowest share price. It's just nuts, yeah. You know, because it went to £1. And as you said, when it was there, it was all on nothing. And it was true. It was all on nothing, basically. The American guys had basically not said a word and we'd all made it up. And then comes crashing down, Callum comes in, saves the company with a raise, and then starts to build a business and goes through the vape channel to start to do that, as well as chill.com. And now here we are, revenues in the millions, and we know that is to be fact. And here we are. So bizarre.
The vape tax is an interesting one, because all I took from it was potentially it could prevent cigarette smokers from actually quitting. Do you know what I mean? It's almost going to have the opposite effect that the government want.
No, because they said that they were going to put a vape tax on, and the taxation on cigarettes was going up by £2 a packet. It was going to be down to the amount of nicotine in the vape,
right?
All the way down. I think it said full tax on sort of the maximum, which I think is 15 or 20 milligrams. I'm not sure how much it is. And then 2/3 of the tax on say 10 milligrams, and then 1/3 of the tax on no nicotine, so just a vape with flavor. Now, whether that is actually what comes to fruition, because ultimately this is Conservative Party policy, and do we believe that they're going to be in power next year is a complete other question, isn't it? Because you asked me, do I think that this budget was going to change people's minds? Well, the answer is no.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to be a few pounds better off because of the national insurance, for sure. But other than that, significantly, you know, what are the significant changes? Whether, you know, there was a few things that will raise
the VAT registration. There was non-DOMs, but there was also the VAT registration increase from
85 to 90.
That's not enough. I mean, to encourage growth, it should be 120 grand. It should be 10 grand a month. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, at least. Yeah. I mean, in my view, that should be probably £180,000 before you pay VAT, because ultimately, you know, we want to encourage those smaller companies to progress and to really go without having the hassle of one, doing VAT returns, and two, I mean, how much do they make from those companies that are between, you know, 80,000 and say 150,000? Probably not very much. It's not a huge amount of money that they're going to be making from those people. But yeah, is it going to affect, you know, especially when they put corporation tax up to 25% as well? You know, it's becoming a place not to do business, and that they're going to find businesses are going to be moving out, not moving in. And yet the whole propaganda, if you like, behind us leaving Europe was that we were going to be the place to attract business, and that most certainly hasn't happened as we speak. Less of me speaking hot air, and let's talk about hydrogen.
Yeah, so let's move on to our first guest this week. Hydrogen Future Industries PLC, listed on AQUIS with ticker HFI, pioneering force in the green hydrogen production sector. Over the past year, HFI has marked significant milestones, from enhancing its intellectual property with international patents acquisition in October 2022, to groundbreaking prototype testing of its advanced aerodynamic wind turbine in Montana, USA. These tests have not only validated the turbine's efficiency and noise reduction capabilities, but also forecasted a substantial increase in energy production. In parallel, HFI's collaboration with Tower Green Holdings Limited in January 2023 underscored their commitment to establishing hydrogen hubs in England, further solidifying their role in a hydrogen economy. Technological advancements continued with the development of an electrolyzer prototype in California, achieving exceptional efficiency rates to 97%, testament to their dedication to innovation and sustainability. Moreover, their facility in Birmingham, UK, signifies the ongoing efforts to refine the hydrogen production system, aiming for a more efficient and cost-effective solution. The acquisition of HFI IP Holdings Limited solidifies their IP position, while their collaboration with the University of Bristol and strategic movements in the boardroom align their vision towards a sustainable future. As they step forward, HFI is not just testing prototypes, but paving the way for a sustainable energy future. HFI is poised to revolutionize the energy landscape with its wind-based hydrogen production system. We welcome Tim Blake, CEO of HFI. Welcome, Tim.
Thank you. Quite an impressive intro.
Before we delve deeper into the company details, I'd like to know a little bit more about yourself first, if you will.
Yeah, well, I suppose with this, my background certainly wasn't wind to start with. I got into the wind and hydrogen following time with motor racing. I used to own motor racing teams back in the day, as it were, in touring cars and GT cars and things, and sort of based out of Wales when work I was doing with Toyota and Lexus sort of came to a grinding halt, largely because of the markets collapsing at that time. And I was asked out of the blue, really, by people within the Welsh government if we could look at the issues with gearboxes in wind turbines. So that's how I started in all of this. We started looking at gearboxes, and we'd been working on a new type of gearbox technology back then. And ultimately, by the time I finished looking at wind turbines, we didn't use a gearbox. So it was a kind of bizarre sort of route. We sort of utilized some of the stuff we knew from the automotive side, not necessarily all motorsport, but the aerodynamic side of a ducted turbine, where we put a shroud around the blades. You know, other people had done that in the past, but it never really successfully translated into a full-scale unit, and sort of felt we knew why that was the case. And as it turns out, we were right. Just took a long time to find a problem and to fix it. So, you know, we spent a lot of time developing that out in the US. That really moved on. So once we spent 15, 18,000 hours of fluid dynamics, and then followed that with wind tunnel work, which verified what we'd discovered virtually. That sort of moved on. Whilst I was in Montana, I started looking at the mining industry, really sort of supplying energy to the mining industry. And part of what I'd patented with the wind side was an energy storage system. And that was sort of based around hydraulics and pressure. But whilst looking at issues with tailings mainly, realized that part of what we were doing, which was electrochemically removing metals from water, is that we'd get hydrogen as a byproduct. And that sort of fed me into the path where over time developed a system, patent system for extracting hydrogen. For hydrogen sort of had its recent coming in terms of energy. So, you know, I've been doing that for a good 6-7 years before it sort of kicked off.
So this came about, this wind turbine, as you were looking for a solution for, you mentioned tailings, and water is a big problem at these mine sites. So tell us how you came up with that as an idea. You know, you need to help this, yeah, to provide a solution. Yeah.
So from the turbine, the wind turbine's great. It works. We're producing, you know, 300% more energy than the normal turbine. Silent, all these kind of things that almost sound too good to be true, but it works. It does what we thought. The problem with renewables, which we've all known about for ages, is the fact that you need to be able to store the energy. The problem with renewables is it's intermittent, and you can't really power anything substantial on intermittent energy. You know, you need to be able to guarantee what you're going to get. So the hydrogen side, once we looked at cleaning these tailings in Montana, this was in Butte, big sort of issue, you could put it. We realized that the hydrogen came out. Then when I started looking at hydrogen, it was clear that it was a better storage medium than compressed air with hydraulics, in terms of once you've got the hydrogen, you can use it for more than just energy. You can transport it around, you can use it for energy, you can use it for gas, you can use it for industrial purposes. So it seemed to make more sense. It was then more a case of solving the issues related to having hydrogen. So, you know, people have known hydrogen is a really clean energy for a long time. There's always been some kind of issue behind it, and producing it cheaply seemed to be the first milestone that we wanted to hit. So in a mining case, over time, the more work I was doing on the mining side, you know, we started working very closely with a very large mining group out in Montana. There was certainly a possibility of creating a system that would enable a mine to produce energy from its own waste through wind. And that's sort of where we went with it. And that's where we are now. We produce hydrogen from wind, but the wind's a lot more efficient. It's less than half the price of current wind to run through, you know, an electrolyzer system that's our own as well, which is far cheaper than current tech, a lot more efficient to produce energy, store it, and then use that stored energy to provide power to the mine. The water side becomes key. As you'll know, in the mining industry nowadays, you know, not only have they got to decarbonize, which is a huge issue, mining accounts for 10% of all energy utilized on the planet or consumed on the planet. So decarbonizing that industry is key towards meeting net zero targets. But an issue they have, especially in places like Africa, regions like that, is water. You can't just take the water and not replace it. And we realized with the system, just one of this is just the way it works with hydrogen. You've got 9 liters of water to produce a kilo of hydrogen, which is sort of the equivalent to a gallon of petrol, say. And then when you use your kilo of hydrogen through a fuel cell, it effectively burns it, mixes it with oxygen, you get back 9 liters of pure water. So your net use of water really is pretty close to zero. So it becomes a really sustainable way to produce large quantities of energy, to store it so you have it on demand and utilize it for mining sites. So if it's windy, it doesn't matter how remote you are, you can be self-sustainable. And that's sort of what drove us down the markets and the tech that we have.
So how did you come to be part of all of this, Tim, in the first place? I mean, obviously you're saying cars, but who did you meet and thought to yourself, oh, I must do this?
It was actually a guy called Brian Rees-Jones. He was sort of in charge of the what used to be called the WDA, the Welsh Development Agency. And we were based out in Anglesey, Bangor and Anglesey, North Wales.
Yeah, great track up at Anglesey, by the way. I drove it a few months ago. What a shit that is.
Well, we were working with them, ironically. But yeah, so out on the coast there, which I suppose anywhere in Anglesey is on the coast. And it was to look at the issues with the wind turbines. They put a lot of wind turbines along the coast of Wales, North Wales, when you drive down the A55, and they were just having problems. So with everything else sort of becoming non-existent on the car world at that point, it gave a lot more time to really look at the wind turbine in depth. And the more I looked, the more problems I found. And it wasn't anything clever. It was a lot of Googling and finding problems. So it sort of went into a wind turbine, then came back to, well, if you're doing a wind turbine, if I was doing it from scratch, going back to first principles, what would I do? And the use of aerodynamics was one. Yeah, so accelerate the air through the turbine gives you more energy, more efficiency. But there's problems to solve with that, which took some time to do, but we did it. There are other problems along the way I couldn't understand for the life of me. Why you had so much weight and equipment at the top of a tower, because you have to be able to maintain it, you know, and if it's 60, 70 meters above the ground, it's not so easy to just nip up there and fix a gearbox or a generator. Plus the things weigh immense amounts of weight. You had the large turbines looking at now, the average weight of that nacelle at the top of the rotor blades is probably 120 tons. Offshore, you know, the latest ones out of China, you're looking at 500-600 tons. That's a lot of weight to stick on the top of a pedestal almost. So that drove us to looking at hydraulics. We developed a hydraulic drive, a smart drive, as we call it, and patented. That meant that we have very little weight at the top of a tower. The electrical generation, if that's what we do with it, we can do numerous things with it, is all done at ground level. And you might have 30 turbines plugged into one set of generators rather than each turbine having its own generator. That means you ultimately end up paying for a lot more power generation than you're actually going to need if you have a use for it, right? So with going back to a mine or or even a power station, which is, you know, another area that we're involved in, you pretty much know what energy you require. So if you need 100 megawatts, for example, you don't want 300 or 400 megawatts worth of generators to just be sat there. And that's effectively what you get with a wind farm, because you're going to get maybe 30% of your total output. So you can't have 100, you're going to have 330 megawatts. So you're paying for a lot of things you don't need. And you're also sticking them all individually, 60, 70 meters up in the air. So we couldn't understand that side. The lighter weight then meant that we could have a tower that's telescopic. So that's sort of automated. And the turbines aren't as big. I mean, that's another thing which I couldn't really understand. They're a lot smaller. You don't need to go to those sizes, and we can effectively stagger them. So it sort of got pulled down the path once I started on it.
Big and sort of stuck up in the air was the thesis that, the higher they get, the more wind they get, and therefore...
Well, I suppose if you go back to the dark ages, a windmill drove, really a large set of gears to grind
flour or whatever,
which would have been on the floor. It wouldn't have been at the top behind the rotor. Once they became individual turbines, I guess, if you want one turbine, it's all in one area. It's probably, it's quite efficient to have such a short transfer of energy. Just didn't make sense to me when we were trying to put these things together. And we have, we consider considerable benefits with utilizing hydraulics. I mean, hydraulics, it's barely any moving parts. You can have hundreds of moving parts in your box. We don't. They're cheap. It's technology has been around for donkey's years. It's not like there's some advancements, don't get me wrong, these variable pumps, variable systems, but by and large, it's a simple system. It also gives us several advantages when it comes to producing, say, hydrogen. With hydrogen, certainly green hydrogen that's required for the net zero stuff, that means that it's going to be produced via electrolysis, and you're going to need renewable energy to power it. So how it sort of works now is it's very rare you would plug a wind turbine straight into an electrolyzer. They're taking the energy from the grid, plugging that into an electrolyzer and producing hydrogen, but buying some kind of tariff off the side where they're paying for renewable energy. If it's coming out of the grid, it's definitely not 100% green energy. It just can't be. So when you take that from the grid, you've got AC, electricity, and you want to feed it into an electrolyzer. The chances are you've got to drop it down through a transformer and then put it through a rectifier to convert it from AC to DC. That all takes money, and that all uses energy. Whereas when we do it the way we do it from hydraulics, we go direct to DC power next to the electrolyzer. So we don't have rectification requirements. So we're not paying the extra cost for that. We're not losing the energy that we would otherwise lose for that. And it simplifies it, makes it cheap. Each electrolyzer has its own power source, blah, 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 blah. So yeah, there's a variety of reasons we ended up doing what we did. It also enables the wind turbine to be used. I mean, you can use it for anything. You don't have to use it to produce hydrogen. But the way I probably describe it in its simplest form is that you can imagine you're on a farm, a tractor has power takeoff on the back, PTO, which is just a rotating shaft that a farmer will plug their equipment onto, do whatever they want to do in a field. If they're pulling a harvester, if they're muck spreading, whatever, it will run off power takeoff. The wind turbine is very much the same. We have effectively a power takeoff at the end that you can plug almost anything into. If you want to do irrigation, you can utilize hydraulics for that. If you want to do air conditioning, you don't need electricity for that. And it cuts the cost of those bits of equipment significantly when you're not going to have a diesel or electrical generator attached to it. And then obviously for the hydrogen, we just go to DC. So we save money in various points there.
Very good. So from the perspective of the company then, who are you dealing with at the minute that you can tell us about? So, you've said there is mining applications here, and I can see it's an absolute no-brainer, especially for mines in sort of far-flung places that you can produce, pretty much net zero in terms of what they're actually trying to do the mining equipment and anything else that is required. And even the water, the reality is a lot of these places are arid, dry places, they can't just have huge amounts of water, whereas you can obviously recycle the water and use it in that way. So, who hydrogen future industries customers going to be?
Right. So obviously, we are dealing with a large mining group, probably one of the biggest, I guess. That's certainly one field that, you know, we've been attached for a number of years. It's not something that's instant. Outside of that, outside of mining, we're working closely. We have collaboration agreement through Bristol University, also with EDF, the utility company, and the UK Atomic Energy Authority, a couple of others, to really use the grid, power stations, especially the likes of nuclear, where at night you can't just turn the system down. So there's projects we're working on with those companies to create hydrogen at night during low demand, store it, and then put it back into the grid during times of high demand. And that works very well for power stations. It means that, you know, they make quite a bit of money on the selling it in when you want to sell it in. For us, it works pretty well because you can add wind to that as well. So the electrolyzer side we've been working fits in with that exceptionally well. And so does the turbine. So with wind, with those types of companies, so large power stations, and you can imagine the system works from say a small farm up to a mine or a power station where they can produce in hundreds of megawatts. It's just a scale question or anything else.
Yeah.
With having a large power station, yeah, it's all well and good converting energy on low demand and putting it in. But with wind, you know, it's the classic problem with wind and solar is you've got to have a connection to the grid. You know, it's a problem when you look at Ireland. I mean, ironically, some stuff, but you look at Ireland with offshore wind. Yeah, you know, there's wind farms out there with no connectivity once it arrives on land. So you need a way to feed that into the grid. And for some time, you know, I've really felt, and it's part of having this system like it is, that without storage, you know, wind's pretty much useless. You can only sell it in. You're only ever going to sell it in when there's not enough nuclear or whatever, because they're going to be your baseline. They're not going to use wind as a baseline. So with those things, if you can connect the wind in with the power station, the hydrogen side there, so the wind is just producing hydrogen 100% of the time and being stored, it goes out into the grid through the existing connections from the power station. So you haven't got that connectivity issue. It also means you're utilizing all that wind energy and you're selling it into the grid or to the gas networks, you know, which is the other spin-off from it, because they're going to dilute natural gas with hydrogen. The percentage of hydrogen you put in, that same percentage is what you remove as carbon when it gets burned. So there's real positives for it. And that's, you know, that's within the government plans and the same around the world. So there's reasons for it. And we feel we're at the forefront with it. It's, as it's a system, you know, it's individual parts that can be used individually, but because the system has been designed to do these things, as opposed to just randomly getting some pieces off the shelf and connecting them together, it gives us great advantages on efficiency and reducing costs and improving reliability, which are all key things when it comes to large supply or small supply. Yeah. And that's certainly something we picked off from the automotive side. You know, you need to be able to service a car and maintain it. You just have to, and that's really the approach we're taking with this.
Yeah, and how cooperative are the government? You know, you mentioned them there, and are they? Is the grants coming forward for new technology? Because obviously we've seen them push everything towards EV and the big drive, and then them pulling back from the sort of 2030 date and pushing it out to 2035. But do you feel that they've kind of neglected the hydrogen fuel cell and hydrogen elements things? And, you know, are they coming forward and saying that we want to reach out to companies that are innovative within this space?
As far as the UK goes, then I would say no. I just feel, you know, they're looking at infrastructure, but they're not looking at production to me. I think it's just a case of people assume it will happen. When you compare it to, say, Europe, certainly if it comes to a hydrogen network for transportation, there's a lot of fuel stations in Germany, Belgium, Holland, France have committed to doing load, Denmark, all these places have them. The UK is certainly the only place I know where the amount of fuel stations has gone down. And gone down significantly. I mean, ironically, I drive a hydrogen car in the UK, so I can speak from very definite experience to say that it's difficult to get fuel right now. I think the plan, as far as the government has it, is to now focus on commercial vehicles with hydrogen. You've still got to have a hydrogen network to achieve that. Other countries, though, you know, America's obviously thrown a lot at it with their Inflation Reduction Act. Australia's thrown quite a bit of money at it. Europe's throwing huge amounts of money at it. And so other places, certainly the UK, I feel the one area where the money is going or going to go is the area that we're involved in, which is which is the power station infrastructure, the large scale things. So being attached to that is great, you know, because you know we're in an area that's certainly going to be developed as time goes on.
Sure. Okay, so let's just go back to the installation, the prototype that you've got running in Montana, USA, with this major. How are the tests going thus far? You know, I mean, are you constantly in communication with them saying, you know, give us the stats and all the numbers and things? And what are the next steps for moving, taking that from prototype to maybe another larger prototype? Or, you know, just talk us through what potentially could happen with that.
Yeah, so the turbine's been going well in Montana. We're just changing over the way we record data. And, yeah, the weather's getting a bit in the way. It was minus 50 over Christmas, and it's, yeah, God knows how much snow and stuff. It's not so easy to work outside on these things. So the next stage, really, with the turbines, and we've had those running outside for over a year, and the initial turbine wasn't certainly not designed to last that long. So that's great that, yeah, they are. The next stage for us, I mean, when I say I'm going to do, say, a 6-meter turbine or a 5-meter turbine, it sounds tiny in the world of wind turbines, because by and large it is. But actually with ours, it produces meaningful amounts of energy. So the next step is to go for those systems. That's partly what we plan to do on the mining site as the next stage of proving the systems through. So smaller scale, generating the hydrogen off the back of that and showing it before going to really large. That size of turbine, just to give you an idea, a 6-meter turbine over the course of a day out in Montana will produce about 280 kilowatts, which is a huge amount for a turbine of that size. To utilize it, you need storage, and then away you go. That's enough to power probably 10, 12 houses. So it's, you know, it's a lot for something of that scale, and everything's modular, so they just connect together, and it's very easy to do with hydraulics. It's a lot easier than doing it with electronics. So that works quite well. After that, I mean, we'll start that this year. Hopefully, that'll be up and running later in the year. That has markets in its own right, which we'll take it to. But then for the mining side, we need to go bigger, probably 15 meters, which is still small in the realms of things when you look at these huge turbines. But that's more than enough for what we need to do on these mining sites. And I'd never envisage going beyond 20 meters, to be honest. It's a big turbine with a cowling, to be honest. So yeah, I mean, we have benefits and reasons for that. One of them really is we don't use a gearbox. If you go too far up, then you have to. The amount of torque we generate is really high. So we're fine where we are on those sizes. But also with the towers being adjustable, we can put the towers closer together and they automate themselves within a wind farm. So you effectively can double stack, is almost what I'm saying. The turbine can be higher than the forward facing turbine in front of it into the wind. So you can put them closer together. It makes them a lot easier to build and service because you do that at ground level. So it sort of hits everything sort of head on in that respect. So that's the next stage as far as that's concerned. We've got a bit more to do on hydraulic drive, which we'll do this year with the electrolyzer side, because I should touch on that. The electrolyzer has been a revelation in our side. We got a lot further than we expected. We looked at licensing some technology initially. We decided against it largely because it was PEM, so a proton exchange membrane, and just felt that you're dealing with rare earths in terms of the iridium especially and the platinum, and to hit net zero targets that the governments have set, there's just physically not enough iridium mined to get close to it. So I can only see the price of those things going up. So it was a case of going back to the drawing board and creating an electrolyzer that didn't use rare earths, which is, you know, alkalines don't, so it's not like that's a rare thing. We went with our own route, which is an anion exchange membrane, and we've got very efficient very quickly. So we're running at sort of 97% efficiency on the cell side. That will change now. We're going to build a larger unit by the end of the year, probably between 10 and 20 kilowatts, I'd think. Again, it's a completely modular system. So that would fit, that's the ideal side to fit with the 6-meter turbine. So the two become, you know, it's a good step. They're commercial products, but they're a good step to the larger products that we would need for the mining industry and other large industries. Yeah. Perfect for a farm or a house, or, well, it's a bit big for a house. But
so where do you see the main applications for this process? And how I suppose, is HFI going to financially benefit from those things?
Well, the main applications are the ones that we're focusing on. So the mining, so 10% of all energy consumed. It's a massive amount. We won't even make a dent in how much power is needed. The money in that side is just simply huge. They've got to change. So I see it there. On a smaller scale going up, I would say mining, small industry, it's the system we're producing as a stepping stone in the mining. So it's a natural progression with what we're doing and to fulfill that side. So I think that's the route we'll take. We're looking for partners, I guess, going forward in collaborations in terms of manufacturing and taking that through, you know, because we're not manufacturing people. It's something that would have to be looked at, partnered with, licensed, whatever, moving forward. But I would say they're the main markets. So the turbine can be used anything in the way of a current turbine would be, you know, whether that be just charging batteries. You know, we have interest in that side through to supplying electricity. As a system, we get the real benefits. Not everybody wants a system. And the same with the electrolyzer. You know, the electrolyzer can be plugged into anything just the same as existing ones. It's just that we've worked, and I should actually highlight this, I guess, on the electrolyzer. We've developed an electrolyzer that's not just an AEM that's you know, half the price of PEM and more efficient. We've also got a few other bits on there that we've done very specifically. So we've designed a system that we will be patenting to work with variable inputs of energy. To most people, that probably won't mean anything. But with an electrolyzer, the reason that PEM, the proton exchange membrane, is favored for green hydrogen over an alkaline electrolyzer that would be cheaper is because they're better with variable supplies of energy. They work better with lower levels of energy. And you can get issues with an alkaline one. If it gets too low, you can cause damage to the system, to the electrodes, etc. But it's still relative. They're not great with low power. They're just better than an alkaline. So we designed a system that would work with fluctuating levels of energy without damaging the system and still operate at full efficiency all the way through. We really, you know, focused on what's best for the way the market's meant to go. So for green hydrogen, you're going to have to use renewables. You're not going to have the same level of energy all day long, which is what an electrolyzer likes. You know, it likes a constant level of power. So we've developed a way around that. We've developed a way where we don't get wash off, which is an effect with an electrode where over time it literally, the catalysts literally wash off. And that's because of the way they attach them to, it's called inking, where they attach them to the electrodes. So we have a way that stops that, eliminates that. So there's a few things we've looked at over time. We haven't just dived in, done the first thing we thought of. We went into it with a structured plan and knocked each one off as we went.
Very good. So Tim, again, if you were talking about the next steps for future hydrogen industries, what are they in terms of, you know, creating maybe a full-size version of this? What is the next steps?
So the next step is the pilot study for the mine, which includes, let's say, five or six meter turbine with the 10 to 20 kilowatt electrolyzer. That's those two systems, as those two bits as a system. That's the next stage this year. I mean, hopefully they'll be done by the end of the year. That would really be where we're at. Thereafter, I suppose it depends on the results from those systems, but in theory, after there, you know, we go up in size. But that system, we're going for those sizes because it's a commercial product in its own right. So we want to go to revenue as quick as we can, but not before it's ready, if you see what I mean. So it's a balancing act of not taking too long and not rushing it through too quickly. That size, I think, fits us well. It's easy to manage. They're a size that can be shipped easily. You know, the costs are lower. It's easier to produce. So it fits with where we are right now.
And the revenue will come how exactly from when these are sort of sold out? Are we going to be manufacturing them, or basically we're just going to be taking a royalty on them, or are we involved in how they work? How is finances going?
Yeah, it'll be on several fronts. Licensing the manufacturing is certainly one of them, and taking a fee from that. Energy wise, you know, people buying the systems is something that we'll be certainly doing too. Again, that may be a license scenario on regions, but they would be the routes we'd take. You know, as I said, to me, it's quickest way to get the manufacturing up and running in multiple locations if needed. But certainly, first off, you know, you'd want to make sure that what you've built works reliably, and you can do that with people that are used to manufacturing. So licensing, I guess, by region, and the sales sort of off the back of that as well.
These miners that you're not able to mention the names of then at the minute, or the miner that you're not able to mention the name, how could that progress if that all works out well for you?
Similar scenario with mining companies. You know, they don't necessarily want to own their energy systems. They would work through, I would guess, through energy PPA agreements. So, you know, they have a power purchase agreement in place. That means that in between those two, you have a developer. Now, where we actually are, we have that laid out for the first site. So, you know, providing we get through these stages now, there is a sort of path laid out to do that. So with mining, I mean, you're looking at huge amounts of energy. It's a lot of money. It's a lot of equipment. So in all honesty, a few of those is enough in the interim to get going to focus with. And I think the most logical way with that would be a PPA. So you're partnering with somebody to do that. So probably an energy supplier or developer, wind developer.
Okay. I mean, if you were an investor sitting here now, why would you tell them to invest?
Well, he's invested. He's invested to the tune of about 25%. It's good to see skin in the game. So it's definitely in your interest to make it work.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it is. It's easy for me to say. It's not really. We've spent a lot of time getting this to where we are. And, I really think, we thought about the practicalities. Quite often you get things out there which, it can seem too good to be true or whatever. With this, we've really focused on trying to keep things simple whilst it being exceptionally efficient. And it's a model we've used on the turbine. It's a model we used on the electrolyzer. And it works. It's as simple as that. The system is designed, the turbines are designed to be easily maintained and maintained in areas that otherwise you might struggle, certainly under developed regions or whatever. A lot of the systems on there are easy to maintain, keep on top of. For cheap energy, going forward, probably the biggest market on this planet that's probably ever had are the net zero targets. The money that's got to be thrown at the transition is absolutely immense. And there's going to be a lot of technologies in there to solve that. No one thing's going to do it, but we certainly feel like we're part of that. When we can get hydrogen down to below $2 a kilo, which is where we think we are, That's low. That's like 5-6 cents a kilowatt for electricity, and that's green hydrogen. That's green power, zero carbon. On top of that, we can supply that energy in areas that are hundreds of miles from the nearest supply of gas or electricity. Certainly, that's a discussion that we've been having for some time on the mining side, because there's obviously real issues with mining. Mining itself, the sort of effectiveness of mining or the cost of mining comes down to the cost of energy and the price of the commodity, and it's a balancing act between the two to what you can mine or not mine. So it works for that. It would work for anything that you need energy for, really, within reason.
Well, there's a really good video on your website on hydrogenfutureindustries.com. There's a deep dive into the patented HFI green hydrogen energy system, and you alluded to that magical $2 kilogram figure, which is obviously detailed. Yeah. So any listeners who want to have a look at that, they can either go over to the website, or I'll put a link in the description of this podcast so that it will link through to the YouTube video. I think it's well worth a watch.
The video, it really, really does spell it out very well, and it gives you the overview and economics of the thing. I think it's a compelling case. I mean, the scenario is that you're going to solve a lot of problems. It obviously is extremely ESG friendly for the miners, for sure. And, I can see this being on many, many mine sites all over the world in the next, coming years and decades. And it will really solve the problem for many miners. I mean, I think some assets will actually be able to be mined because of this situation. Whereas at the minute, they're going to be left alone. Whereas, this will allow mines to exist that probably, because of the extra capex required to bring in stuff, will probably not exist. So I'm excited as it moves forward. It's got obviously a very low market capitalization at the minute, and I think it's one to consider and purchase now while it's on sale, if you like, because I think things are going to move forward.
Thank you.
Okay, on that note, we'll say Tim Blake, CEO of HFI Energy Systems. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Phil. Thank you, Kev. That's great.
Thanks, Tim. Speak to you again soon.
Cheers.
So let's move on to our second guest company this week. We're joined by Jonathan Owen, CEO of Metals One. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thanks, guys. First time. What did I say? First time in the oven with you guys.
In the roast. Yeah.
Amongst the parsnips and the onions. Yeah.
Absolutely. So let's take a look at Metals One. Obviously, successfully listed its ordinary shares on the AIM market, the London Stock Exchange, under the ticker Met One in July 2023. The company's focused on advancing battery metal projects in Finland and Norway, highlights the strategic position with significant exploration potential in European brownfield sites near or similar to high-quality nickel sulfate deposits, aiming to supply the growing demand from Europe's electric vehicle and battery manufacturers. In Finland, the Black Schist project boasts proximity to the Talvivaara mine and contains significant inferred mineral resources and exploration targets for nickel, copper, cobalt, and zinc. The proceeds from the share placing are earmarked for further exploration and development of this project, with up to $1 million funded by Gunsing through a farm-in agreement. The Norway Rana project offers potential for nickel, copper, and cobalt mineralization, with exploration carried by King's Rose Mining under a farm-in agreement, aiming for a significant stake in the project through state investments and contributions. These initiatives are driven by the escalating demand for battery metals fueled by Europe's commitment to EV adoption and the need for sustainable mining practices. The EU's Critical Raw Materials Act sets ambitious targets for domestic mining of critical materials, including nickel and copper, to address the anticipated supply shortages and meet the growing demand from the EV sector. So just tell us more from the listing event to now about progress thus far. Obviously, BlueJay extending their lock-in and also the latest results from the Black Schist drill program, please.
Yeah, sure. So starting from the beginning, last year was a tough year, I think, for all markets, particularly for natural resources. So, we got over the line end of July with the IPO on AIM. It was, it was a challenge, but we got there. And I think, I was flicking through the sign-in book at the London Stock Exchange when the big hoo-ha there. And I think we're only one of four that year successfully listing on AIM. And that's really testament to the quality of the assets that we've acquired off BlueJay and SRH, and testament to the perception of quality of the team in that, going ahead and delivering the work program, unlocking the value in those assets. So we hit the ground straight away, and we were drilling in December, so that's a pretty quick turnaround from listing, actually being in cash, having the asset signed over on the listing date, and then moving through then to refining the work program towards then drilling our first target at the beginning of December, and actually getting that done and wrapped up before Christmas, which is a huge achievement. And in the meantime, while that was being prepped, we took a step back and looked at the region, looked at the Black Schist belt that runs across that part of Finland, did a regional review, and started pegging new ground as well. So there are some carpetbaggers around that are following successful exploration companies and basically pegging ground around their targets. We were ahead of the curve and got those areas pegged out as soon as we listed. And so currently now, moving forward now, we've got the assays in from First Draw Program, which you probably saw released a few weeks ago. We updated our project strategy then for the Black Schists. And ultimately, I'm starting to ramble a little here, maybe I'll let you guys cut in a second, but I think the point to make here is that as an exploration company, we're very focused on delivering a tangible outcome at the end of this process. So, and what is that? That is unlocking an asset in the ground and effectively giving it an NPV, a material, tangible, measurable value that we can then either take to production ourselves, JV, sell on to one of the majors or mid-tier mining companies. And that's the process that we're going through. We're very focused on that. So taking the assets that we have through the maturity curve of the JORC process of basically increasing the confidence levels in the grades and continuity in those assets, increasing the volumes of those assets, and then building what we call a preliminary feasibility study, basically an initial business case that puts some numbers to it. What's it going to cost to what's the CapEx, what's the OpEx, what's the market, and then delivering that business case that we can take effectively to the bank.
Very good. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Jonathan. How did you end up in this position?
Yeah, so I'm a mining engineer. I'm a fellow of the Geological Society as well. So I'm a mining engineer that wears a geo hand time to time. My background is mainly in operations. I've been building and running mining operations, predominantly in Africa, across a range of commodities, including gold, diamonds, industrial minerals, helium one at the outset in the late 2010s. And then I moved into consulting. So I have a consulting company that works with mining companies, junior exploration companies that are moving into the mining space. We help them basically ramp up their projects to steady state production. We help them de-risk that process so that they actually deliver on the promises that they made. We're also going to help turn around failing mining operations as well, so get back on their feet and turning a profit. So that's my old gig. Metals One is my new gig. This is a very exciting opportunity. I joined quite quickly in the process. I joined as one of the founders and initial investors, threw a lot of my own capital into this as well. So this is very much like all of us on the board. We've got a lot of skin in this game.
Give us an idea of how much skin in the game you have on the board, just so people can have an idea.
Yeah, I think collectively we're sitting around about 8-9% at the moment. So it's quite a significant chunk.
Okay, very good. And do you have significant shareholders on top of that then? Who would they be?
Yeah, so BlueJay, so with the assets that we acquired, the Rana asset in Norway, we acquired off SRH. SRH is a small group of individuals, geologists and financiers, and we acquired that based on an equity basis. So collectively, the SRH shareholders represent just under between 20-25% of the current registry. And then BlueJay, again, we acquired the Baxter's projects off them on an equity basis, and they account for just under 30% of the shareholding.
And they extended their lock-in, as I alluded to, didn't they, Jonathan? I believe there was an announcement, so just sort of showing commitment to the fact that they...
That's right, yeah. So on listing, it was around about 75% of that register was locked up, at least 12 to 24 months. You know, our share price hasn't been doing amazing things since listing on very little liquidity. So, you know, it's important to make for our stakeholders to signpost their commitment to us and their belief, again, in the assets and then the team that delivering on that. So yeah, they've locked up, and others as well have locked up well beyond the end of 2024 into 2025.
Very good.
So I was just looking at the latest RNS, where I think you gave a Blackschist project strategy update.
Yeah.
And I think the take-homes from that were you basically aim to significantly advance the project by increasing geological confidence and volumes through this infill and step-out drilling, targeting, is it the R1 and P5 areas, and basically rapidly identify and secure new targets across the Kainu schist belt to enhance the portfolio of critical minerals. And then obviously that was underpinned by the recent drilling success and aims to leverage advanced exploration technologies to de-risk and expedite the discovery of mineralized black schist. And then I think you also said that your ambition is to define a substantial 200 million ton resource in the Paltamo area. So can you just tell the listeners what that means? You know, I mean, that sounds like quite a big ambition, 200 million tons. And also over, I mean, what sort of period are we talking that would be put into production?
Yeah, okay. So why 200 million tons? Okay, it's a slightly arbitrary number, but ultimately it represents... That would represent a world-class deposit. So that's a deposit that will sustain a life of mine of well beyond 20 years. It would sustain a production rate of 20 million tons per annum, which is quite significant. That's what we believe would attract, if we were to look to vend the project on, sell it to a responsible operator. That's the kind of scale that we believe that an Anglo or a Rio Tinto, one of the majors, or Glencore, Trafigura would look to, you know, would beat their interest. Having said that, half of that, you know, 100 million tons would still interest a lot of people, particularly mid-tier mining companies. And depending on where the market is in, by the time we get to opening that mine, so in a few years' time, the market will be in a better place, a different place, and even the majors might look at sub 100 million tons. To put it in perspective, in terms of the challenge of getting there, not such a great challenge. We're currently sitting on 28 million tons at the R1 target. P5, we're sitting at currently up to 24 million tons. In terms of timeline, it's our hope to, our intention to get that up to around about 80 million tons by the end of this year. So that's using the current, our existing cash. You know, that's with the funding that we already have in hand at IPO. So we're not looking to go back to the market this year to raise more to cover that. So that would take us up to around about 18 million tons. And you're right, the process to get to that is really focused very much on R1 and P5. So the step-out drilling is about increasing the volume. So basically stepping out of the existing footprint, if you like, of what we have in terms of the ore body in the ground. The infill drilling is about increasing the confidence level. So basically getting more data points within the existing footprint, so you can basically upgrade your confidence levels, that they're the mineral grades that you've got across that ore body. And there is a classification system that goes behind this we adhere to, that ultimately, you know, we've got to tick certain boxes, ensure that we've got a quality control, quality assurance process in place, so that when other third parties look at our data set, you know, they have the confidence that data set is real. This, you know, it's not fictitious or faulty in any way. With that confidence, then they can then, a third party can then build their own due diligence, build their own business case on that data set. So that's the process we're going through. Then to get us to 200 million tons, yeah, that will be something for 2025, probably into early 2026 to get us to that level.
And Jonathan, what is the situation here? I mean, I'm looking at that and say this really isn't that much of an exploration. I mean, you're pretty sure the resource is there. You have to prove it up. Is that fair? I know that's exploration, but...
Yeah, no, it's still exploration.
Ultimately, system is there. And, yeah, you know, as you put the holes in, I mean, geologically, you're fairly confident that it's all there?
We are. We have a very high level of confidence. And why is that? Well, it's the nature of the ore body. So it's a little bit like, you can think of it as like coal, you know, coal fields, if you're going to do like coal mining. You know, they're pretty contiguous, homogeneous. So they have a continuity that ranges many kilometers. You know, you can basically go underground and start mining this stuff in a certain, in any direction for X number of miles. It's a similar situation with the Black Schist, maybe not quite as easy as that, but it's strata bound. It's relatively homogeneous. It's a case of just finding where it outcrops to the surface and then following it, so, you know, following its trend line. That's where the exploration comes in. And we use a lot of geophysics, airborne gravity surveys, etc., to like fishing, really, with the sonar. You know, you get an idea there's a fish there. You don't follow the current and the directions, and, you know, you pick up more. So we're following the outcroppings, and which then head underground, and we're following them then with the exploration techniques that I just mentioned, like the EM and geophys. So relatively straightforward. Well, it's straightforward on paper. In terms of we're talking about the focus on P5 and R1 in terms of getting those tonnages up. We still have other targets. We have, as I said, done a regional review in the whole Black Schist belt that runs from Paltimo, from P5 all the way down to Raptabara. It's probably 80 kilometers. And there are a number of other highly prospective targets that we've identified along the way. I think I mentioned in that strategy document the K1 target. That's next on our list. Again, this in itself could be another P5. So it's pretty exciting. You know, I'm putting a value out there on the potential of P5 in terms of that 200 million tons. And if you want to, we could talk about the in-situ metal value, what's actually sitting in 200 million tons of black shit. It's a pretty scary number. But like I said, there are other targets in the pipeline, in the sausage machine that we're going to be
doing. Yeah. And what sort of grades are we talking about when we're talking about nickel, copper, and cobalt and zinc? I mean, what are we talking about?
Yeah, so for a black schist, you're looking around about 0.2% nickel, 0.1% copper. It doesn't sound a lot, but compared to a traditional, say, or a Canadian nickel sulfide, which would be around about sometimes 0.4%. Or maybe 1% if you're lucky. So they tend to be relatively low volumes. What we're looking at here is volume. It's huge volumes. I mean, 200 million tons is a massive volume, but at 0.2% nickel, that equates to over $7-8 billion worth of metal in the ground there.
And then also quite, I believe, a low production cost. And there's also the environmental sustainability through this use of this bioheat leaching extraction method. Do you want to just quickly talk about the low cost production cost and that extraction method?
Yeah. Well, that's right. So the black schists, I mean, they're easy mining. They're relatively shallow. The overburden you've got to get through is literally meters, 5-10 meters of glacial till, so basically gravel. And then you get to this quite nice, soft, crumbly stuff, the black schist. So easy digging, easy to transport. And then when you get to the processing, so the mineral itself is amenable to bioheat bleaching. So bioheat bleaching is one of the lowest cost methods of extracting metals from ore. It uses, as you can guess, bacteria that are basically percolated over pads of ore, basically heaps of ore on the ground over a period of time. They leach out the metals, and we collect the water, the liquor, if you want to call it that, and the metals precipitate out of that. So it's very low cost in terms of mining and the processing of the metals. It's also low cost in the sense of carbon footprint. So if you look at, I mean, it's been in the news recently, the Indonesian nickel producers, their production costs in terms of the environment are horrendous. The carbon footprint of the kilogram of nickel produced by Indonesia is over 10 times that would be produced in Canada and maybe 20 times more than we would be producing here. How do we know that? Well, we've got Terra Firma's mine next door, just up the road from us. It's the Talvivaara mine, mentioned it early in the podcast. They've been producing the black schists. They've been producing nickel from black schists for a number of years now. So we've got a good benchmark there. It's basically the same ore. So we have a very good idea of what it's going to cost to produce, what it's going to cost from an environmental perspective. And it's de-risked our projects significantly because they've proven that bio-bleaching works for this type of mineral. They've proven the market for it. And it does sometimes sound a little bit too easy.
So do they want more ore?
They've got plenty of ore to keep them going. The bottlenecks with the mines is generally the processing plant. The processing plant is the single biggest capital expenditure in a mining operation. Not easy to scale it by any stretch of the imagination. Yeah, quite often it's cost effective to go and build a new mine, you know, fresh out of the box, and do it that way. Whether they want to scale or not, you know, that's a question. Maybe they'll be an offtake partner in the future. Maybe they'll acquire our assets and have those feed into there. Like I said, the constraint there is the processing. But you know, we're all feeding into a market where there's a significant structural deficit already, and it's only increasing. Now, there's just not enough nickel to meet the growing demand over the next, you know, let's say 20 years. So that's, you know, that's what we're feeding into. We're all feeding into that that market.
There's ultimately, you're not going to mine this. You're going to basically prove it up and then put the for sale sign up.
We'll see. You know, I am a mining engineer. I have built mines and taken them to production. Having said that, we've got a board full of great deal makers. You know, when that point comes, we'll decide. You know, and they'll be based on what's best for the shareholders. And bear in mind, you know, we are all shareholders, so you know, that'll be the decision to be made in the future. But with the skills and the interest amongst the board and the management team, we've got the ability to go either route.
So from the point of view of this nickel, copper, cobalt, zinc sheesh that you will get the stuff from. I often ask people, how much is this worth, you know, per ton of ore, if you like. So in other words, you get in there, you scrape a ton. How much is the metal content worth per ton?
Well, we would, I'd do this to become a calculator out, but you can quickly do it. So 8 billion divided by 200 million tons will give you your dollar value per ton of ore. It's going to be relatively low because of the low grade of the stuff. I think what's important, if you look at the economics of a mine, it's your cost of production. You're all in sustaining cash costs. So not just the cost of actually digging the stuff and moving it around, so the labor and the fuel, but also the cost of sustaining your capital, maintaining your processing plant, reinvesting in the infrastructure and so on. And in the mining world, we call that the all in sustaining cash cost. And the all in sustaining cash cost for Talvivaara, for example, we believe to be around about $12,000 per ton of nickel produced. Compare that then to the market at the moment, which everyone is saying is on its knees, and I don't believe it is by any stretch of the imagination. That's currently sitting at 17,000 tons. So you're producing for 12, you're selling for 17. Last year, nickel was at 20. You know, the long-term average at the moment is around about $22,000. So that's the great thing about these black schists, is that it makes for mining operations in the first quartile. So they're some of the lowest cost producers in the world, which means they're going to make a profit through all phases of the commodity cycle, up and down. Good times, bad times, you know, while they're closing 30-year-old mines in Australia that frankly should never have been reopened when they last closed. You know, on the other side of the spectrum, we've got the black schist, the Terra Firma, the Talvivaara that are producing, as I said, profits through thick and thin.
So from the point of view, when you say the nickel price and it's 17, is that a cost that includes the copper credit, the cobalt credit, the zinc, or are they all add-ons?
So no, that doesn't include those. So the cost per ton that I mentioned, say $12,000 cost per ton, that's just for the nickel. But that would be for the whole suite of metals. So and that includes some uranium as well, and copper, cobalt, nickel, as you mentioned, and some zinc. The market rate of 17,000 is purely just for the nickel. So there's a lot of upside if we consider then the copper credits, the zinc, the uranium, etc.
Yeah, I mean, you could be talking probably in terms of the overall nickel that you could increase that by at least another 50% with the copper, the cobalt, the zinc, by what you're saying.
Possibly, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to put definitions up, but anyway, when you're saying it's at the bottom of the market now and it's still highly profitable, you know, $5,000 a ton on any commodity as profit margin is pretty phenomenal, you know, so yeah.
That's That's right. I've operated in gold operations, and I always chuckle. People can be quite romantically obsessed with gold stocks and gold operations, and thinking it by nature of the commodity, it must be doing well. Frankly, they generally don't. You know, the price of gold goes up, well, so does everything else. All your input costs go up, your fuel, the lube, the labor, everything else. So while everyone's focused over that, you know, all those guys on the base metals, that's where the real margin's to be made.
Absolutely. So, I mean, it sounds like the future holds the potential for Metals One to either directly take these resources into production, enter into joint ventures, or sell to existing operators, thereby contributing significantly to Europe's critical mineral supply chain at a reduced economic and environmental cost. So I think that's the sort of take home from it. Would you agree with that, Jonathan?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I was going to say, on that note, we'll say Jonathan Owen, CEO of Metals One, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, guys.
So what else has been going on this week? Well, as you alluded to at the top of the show, we attended the Master Investor Show at the Business Design Centre in London, and we caught up with a certain CEO we haven't had on for quite some time.
So here we are at the Master Investor Show, and we're joined by Ed McDermott, CEO of Seed Innovations. Welcome, Ed.
Hey, guys. Good to see you.
Absolutely. So it's a bit of a buzz here, isn't it? Very early in the morning, 9:30 on the Saturday. So tell us, Ed, how are things going in Seed Innovations in terms of the recent announcement regarding the Little Green Farmer and also Avextra?
Yeah, look, things are actually going well. Obviously, from a share price perspective, we're still, I suppose, at the mercy of what is a very difficult market. But we're in a very, very unique position where we're sitting on, relative to our market cap and our share price, a huge amount of cash, well over 6 million, 7.1 million of cash and cash receivables, as reported on 30th of September 2023. So we're in a very good space. Obviously, there's been some of that spent on the buyback, but that's been quite a gentle process. In terms of the portfolio assets, we're in a position where we've actually got largely very well-funded portfolio assets, which I think is critical, especially at a time like this. I honestly believe that we're a safe haven in what is a very turbulent market. You know, we're 130% cash backed, effectively. So you can buy the company for less than cash, and certainly a hell of a lot less than net asset value today.
Yes, well, it seems I keep meeting giants because Ed is also extremely tall. But Ed, this is an incredible position to be in, really, in a market that, you know, it basically values all of your companies and park companies that you own at less than zero, which is a bizarre situation. So quite obviously to employ some of that capital to buy your own shares back makes common sense at this moment in time. Do you see that being extended, or if this continues, or it is what it is, what you've decided to do?
Look, I think we have three clear options where it comes to how do you deliver back to shareholders. One, share price appreciation. Two, special dividends or regular dividends. In our case, you'd be looking more at special dividends than a regular dividend. And of course, share buybacks. So at some point, as we've already telegraphed the market, we're looking to try and do all three of those things. We obviously want to get the share price up. It's not in our interest for it to be down this low, despite the ridiculous conjecture you see on bulletin boards. I won't go into that, but ultimately...
Let's not talk about bulletin board comments.
Well, look, I think it's relevant. You know, we're at a point in a market where everyone is just at peak distress, I think. Everyone's just absolutely gutted about where their share price positions are. Sometimes I see these comments and it's like, it sounds like they're absolutely nailing it elsewhere. But, you know, with us, it's bad news. I just think we're in a really bad position with market malaise across all sectors, really. You know, you've seen some blue sky and things like AI, and that's the latest buzzword. And, you know, good for them. My job is, yes, I worry about share price, but my job is to try and make sure that the assets that we're invested in, that we get the best possible result of them. So that's what I focus the vast majority of my attention. However, we're always out, you know, at these events, making sure that we're here. Investors can come and see us. We put on an investor evening for Seed. We got some really great investors turn up, but, you know, so many people who complain and want to ask questions didn't turn up. But, you know, we're trying to do all the things we can to try and engage with investors and also do our best for them.
And if it was your money, okay, are we at a point in the market where there are so many bargains out there that actually you should be going and buying stuff or not?
I think we're at a really critical point, right? We're sort of, as I see it, again, this is my opinion, we're past what I would call peak fear. And typically there's a lag between peak fear and any kind of liquidity events coming back into the market. We're seeing green shoots at the moment, but I think the key is not to rush your capital back in. And I think Seed, or in its former guise, Fast Forward, made the mistake historically where it had big chunks of cash coming back in, it rushed that capital straight back out. We're in a value market now. We're in a buyer's market. So not all companies are created equally. There's a hell of a lot of work to do, and I would rather do the work, make sure that we make our investments stick, because it's one thing to make an investment, but the terms that you go in on, the protections that you have if things go badly, you know, those things take a long time to actually put into practice, but it will pay huge dividends in the future. So yes, there's definitely some brilliant value out there in the market, but I think you have to do more research than you've ever done. You have to get deeper and deeper into these things, because right now, if you're a company that needs to raise capital, we've all seen it. People are having to half and more their market caps in order to do that. So the true cost of capital, you know, you're a £5 million market cap and you want to raise 2 million, it's costing you 4 million to raise two. So you really have to be careful where you go. You really have to understand the cash position. You really have to understand how that money's being spent.
And do you remember that deal that you were slagged off right at the top of the market that you managed to take cash for? How do you feel about that deal now?
It's one of those things. You're only ever going to take grief at the time of it happening. No one's ever going to congratulate you later.
But we'll congratulate you now. That's
very kind. I'm not looking for congratulations. The congratulations I want to see is, I don't need a pat on the back from anyone. I just want to see the share price improve. I want to see investors get returns. I'm a shareholder of the company, remember. This is, you know, I put in, you know, 18 months plus of net income into that. So, you know, you could argue I'm not saying I've been working for free for the last 18 months, but that, you know, I am committed to this, and that's all I want to see. And, you know, we're going to do it.
My own personal view is we've had, you know, CBD scenario disaster. Literally everything is dying. And you have managed to still navigate that because you haven't really had any of your companies die from what I can see. And hopefully some of those are prospering. So.
Look, we've been lucky, good, whichever you want to call it, but I don't mind which one. I think we can demonstrate that we've done it in three different market cycles. We've done Nuvera at the beginning of the cannabis cycle through the boom. We've done EMAC, which arguably was in a real trough in the market, but you know that was a real cash return in both cases. And then Avextra as well in another very doomy, gloomy situation. So arguably in the cannabis space, we've done well. Of course, we've had some bitter results on some of our smaller investments in the space. And obviously some of our legacy investments that were done well before my time. And, you know, that's not an excuse. That's just the facts.
You were going to be blockchain galore at one point, right? And then,
well,
what about Juvenescence? I see that they're at the thing. Do you still hold Juvenescence?
Yeah, we do. Look, we've got two of our investee companies at least are here. We have Clean Food Group, which is a really, really exciting prospect. Juvenescence, which is an exciting prospect, but it's going to be, I think, a relatively slow burn Juvenescence to get to a point of liquidity. But, you know, you have Greg Bailey, who has had some monstrous success over the years. The guy knows what he's doing. You know, I'd rather be patient on that and see a multiple of the value we have today than try and rush that out the door for a discount to NAV. I mean, it would just be a stupid move when those guys have clearly had huge success with companies like Biohaven historically, which, you know, they took that company from a London listing where it was, you know, multi-hundred million to, you know, double-digit billions on their exit, so in America. So, you know, it takes time. And obviously when you have a terrible market for a few years like we've had, of course, that, you know, that's a delaying factor.
Yeah,
but
time period. But maybe catch-up's going to be much quicker than everybody thinks.
Look, I think, as I said, we're seeing some green shoots now, and I think that's really encouraging. So I just think my advice to investors is, look at your downside protection. That's why I'm out here talking about seed, because I think the downside protection is, you know, if the share price never improves, we're going to be in a position where we can still sell the assets for, you know, realistically a multiple of what the shares are trading at today. You know, there are other companies out there as well that are, you know, showing that they're good custodians of capital. And, you know, those are the kind of companies you need to be looking at. You've always got to balance your portfolio out to something kind of half sensible where, you know, at least you're not going to dump all your money, and that they're, you know, even if it takes a bit longer, but you don't know. You know, for an example, the case of seed, we could turn around tomorrow, and this is not a leading statement, but you know, Clean Food Group is absolutely smashing it at the moment. Juvenescence could very well,
two of those to do a real good return, like, you know, 5x, 10x,
and you've got a multiple of market cap again, and then you're in a position where those, you know, I want to be able to do everything. I want the share price to increase. I want to be able to pay out special dividends. And, you know, if the share price does increase, we'll buy the shares back, because ultimately, we believe in the larger, particularly the larger assets that we hold. And we believe we're in a real value market, and ultimately we're going to be making some good investments where, you know, we're not far away. We've had a few, such as Reset, the Australian psychedelics company that we wanted to invest in. Unfortunately, AIM and our King's Council had a differing view on it, which is it's a shame that's how things are. But what can you do? We really tried hard, and that would have been, I think, a very good outcome for us. But that's life.
Well, Ed, we'll let you get on and see if you can encourage some people to stick some money in the seed.
Sow the seed, and we wish you all the best, Ed.
Seed. Yeah, very good. Well, look, thanks very much, guys. It's great to see you in the flesh. It's been a while. So enjoy the day.
Yeah. Cheers, Ed.
So let's have a look at some of the movers and shakers this week. The one that's moved the most, really, is that Sabian Technology is up about 67%, but also Teck Minerals are up 51%. I mean, you could argue they potentially shouldn't have dropped back to the sort of 0.65 range, but it was nice to see Teck Minerals move back above the 1 pence. I think like 1.2 was paid earlier in the sort of middle of the week, but it finished the week around 1 pence. What do you make of that move? And, you know, potentially, do you think we should be hearing some news finally? Do you think that people are anticipating the prospectus and everything to happen for the RTO?
Yeah, I spoke very briefly with Alex before the weekend was out. I think it was on Thursday when I landed in London, and he was very positive about stuff that was progressing. He couldn't obviously say much to me, but he said once we get the stuff over the line, he's looking forward to doing an interview. Basically, I was asking him, when are we going to do the next stuff? So I'm hoping in the next few weeks, I can't really put a timeline on it, but we'll have some more speak and some more chat about that. I mean, the share price was ridiculous. No harm to you. You know, I think it was £8 or £9 million valuation. And with this increase, it's gone up to sort of 12 million market cap, which again, in the context of things with owning half a Recyclist and then they will own all of Recyclist, is frankly laughable. Especially when you've got the mining assets in there as well. So yeah, it's great to see, a long way to go because it's worth significantly more even than a penny. You know, I think it probably, to say it was worth a couple of times that is probably fair.
No, so one thing we wanted to correct on last week was, I think it was mention of potentially TR1 from Kibo Energy and talking about MAST and then selling down. I think they did actually announce holdings in the company that they'd reduced their position to, I think it was about 30% in the end. So it seems like there still are a significant. There was one earlier in the week that was like 38%, and they ended up in a resulting situation of 33%. So it does seem like that, you know, they're still holding on to the stock at that one.
Yeah, I really did think, based on the volume that we saw there, sort of 120 million shares, I think it was, or 122 million shares, that they must have been selling significant amounts, but it doesn't look like. I mean, they sold quite a few million, but nowhere near that. So it must have been a trader's dream in that day, because there must have been buying, selling, buying, selling, buying, selling, and just taking the bit in between, if you like, for that many shares to have changed hands. So yeah, the other one that we saw doing okay this week, still again massively under the radar, Zambian Copper is going to be the forefront of this business, which is Jubilee Metals. There was an article written by Charles Archer this week, and Charles is going to be doing a podcast with Leon early next week, so watch out for that one.
They'd also put together a dedicated board of directors for both the Jubilee's South African operations and also a dedicated board of directors for the Zambian board, basically, for the Zambian operations through, I think, as a yet to be nominated Zambian subsidiary of Jubilee. So that looks like they're putting all the, you know, the right people in the right places for you know, for obviously, you know, furthering their efforts in obviously in both South Africa and in Zambia. So, and you know, that comes on the back of the announcement of these copper projects that they've announced, you know, the Munkoyo and the different tailings projects. So that one looks like it's priming up nicely, doesn't it?
It also tells you about what the magnitude of what's going to be happening in Zambia is, that it needs its own separate board.
Yeah. There was also an announcement, I think we sort of, it came in on middle of the week. There was Ben's Creek. There's, I think they announced an amended loan instrument and security agreement, didn't they, with under Avani. I think they, basically a facility of 7.5 million plus an additional 2.5 million as at the discretion of the lender, and advanced a total of the 5 million under the WCF. So they agreed, Avani agreed to restructure the outstanding loan note and accrued interest of about $6.5 million that were put in place with Ben's Creek in July 2023, obviously as announced to market. So what do you make of that?
Well, it basically just looks like Avani making sure as they can that they're going to get their money back, to be honest. The way it looked like it was structured to me from reading was that Avani were going to be taking a good proportion of profit, if you like, but only profit, and paying these loans down. So all based on the coal price. As long as the coal price stays reasonably high, and actually if it increases, then Ben's Creek is going to progressively look much, much better. The downside risk, obviously, is if the coal price is weakened again, then they're going to be in trouble because they're basically probably not going to be able to meet these payments. So I think it's good, but the reality is Avani are obviously saying we want our money back, and if we don't get our money back, then we can have control of the assets, I think is basically what the RNS said. So there's positives in the fact that the debt's going to be paid down, and once the debt is paid down, then you've got a completely different company, but they're at the mercy of the coal price. Which was always the case, really, with Ben's Creek, let's be honest. It was never not the case that the coal price was going to dictate how successful this has been. Now, nobody in their right mind could have predicted, one, the coal price went up to $415 a ton and then crashed to $170, $180, $190, whatever it was, at its absolute worst. I mean, that is just a ridiculous amount of volatility in a commodity like this, which costs so much money in terms of, fixed costs to bring it out of the ground. But yet, you know, I still look at things like Warrior Met Coal. The Warrior Met Coal's at all-time highs, and yet Ben Creek is at all-time lows. So there are obviously other issues, and there have been other costs involved have been coming out, and basically I think from what they've said in the RNS saying we want our money back, and then we're going to run the business, because they've obviously appointed two board directors and now appointed the CEO as well. So let's see what happens. We're hoping to talk to him. I've had brief conversations with him. Chris Walker, CEO, started on Wednesday, I think it was, and I did message him saying, can we speak to him? Adam's response was he started today. So, hopefully we can speak to him in a not too distant future.
Anything else, really? I mean, it's been a relatively quiet week. There's Challenger Energy. They entered into a farm out with Chevron relating to a 60% interest in the area off one block offshore Uruguay. Under the deal, Chevron will acquire 60% operated interest in the block and pay Challenger $12.5 million in cash up front. Chevron will also carry 100% of Challenger's shares of costs up to $50 million for a 3D seismic program over the block. And if Chevron decides to drill an exploration well after the seismic work, it will carry 50% of Challenger's costs up to $20 million for the initial well. So good to see these small caps, you know, these AIM stocks actually getting into bed with a major like Chevron. Mattioli Woods, don't know much about them. So there was a few acquisitions, and the other one was Mattioli Woods, which I don't know much about it, but it made the RNS hot list on Friday with basically they agreed to be acquired by a wholly owned subsidiary of Pollen Street Capital. And under those terms of the recommended cash offer, Mattioli Woods shareholders would receive 804p a share, or £8.04 per share in cash, which would value the entire issued ordinary share capital of Mattioli Woods at approximately £432 million. The offer price of 804p represents a premium of 34% to Mattioli Woods' closing price 600p on the 7th of March, the last business day prior to the commencement of the offer period. So nice to see these, these offers coming in and acquisitions coming into these, again, sort of mid-cap companies.
Yeah, absolutely. The other two that were at PDAC were Conroy Gold and also First Class Metals. And the other company, actually there's three of them, the other company that were there was Golden Metal Resources and maybe Power Metal Resources, but I think they were actually in Saudi Arabia, if I remember rightly, because I was speaking with Sean before he went. Power Metal Resources is just a call out. How the hell has it gone down to 0.775 again, having raised at a premium to 1p and then it went to 1.25 when nothing but good stuff has happened. I don't get that. It's just bizarre. And a shout out to the gold price. I think we touched $2,200 an ounce at some point there on Friday, I think it was.
Yeah, so we've had basically two all-time highs this week. We've had gold busting through the all-time high. Finished the day around on Friday around the... If you want it in the UK price, we're looking at £1,675.02. So do the conversion of it. But basically, that's the 52-week gold high.
US dollar was 2,179.
Yeah, so 2179 being the all-time high. And we also had the Bitcoin price in the week hit the all-time high of $69,000 per Bitcoin. Crazy.
$69,000 for the king's new clothes.
Yeah.
Bizarre.
Give me your comments on gold price first.
On gold, gold is catching up basically. Because basically we've just gone through a very inflationary period of time. Normally gold excels at that time. When you look at physical gold, how much does it cost to get out the ground? Quite obviously with inflation across the board going up, then whether they like it or not, gold miners' extraction costs have increased. So there is always going to have to be a margin there in terms of all in sustaining costs of bringing the stuff out the ground and what people will sell it for. The fact is that the fiat currencies are under a huge amount of pressure. You saw the British pound increase by, you know, 3-4 cents against the US dollar over the last week or so. Why, at a time when the US are saying they're going to reduce rates and maybe the UK is not going to be reducing rates that quickly? I think it's basically just because ultimately, the indebtedness of the US is going to come home to roost. And that is going to be a big bonus to gold. You know, the dollar index has dropped from 104, 105 to 102.7. You know, we're in uncertain times still, for sure. But you see now commodities in general are starting to just perk up again. And the commodities themselves are doing very well. And yet the small cap miners, explorers are still in the gutter. So when is that going to change? I think it was Oliver Friesen from Golden Metal Resources basically made the statement. I don't know whether it was his or someone else's, but one of two things is going to happen. Either the resources themselves are going to plummet, as in gold's going to plummet, copper's going to plummet, whatever, or that the mining stocks have got to catch up. Because they're so far behind. They're like light years behind. So that's my thoughts on it. In terms of Bitcoin, then, you know, my views on Bitcoin have not changed. I really do think it's the emperor's new clothes. And, you know, I think it's going to survive. I think it's going to be there. Maybe it will continually be worth more. I don't know. But at some point, the penny's going to drop that there's nothing tangible there.
Yeah, there's a different angle on it, though, this time, isn't there? Do you remember that we saw there was strong momentum for these ETFs, remember, that launched in January? So that's a different angle. And we saw something like $8 billion of net inflow since hitting the market on the 11th of January. So that's a big, big factor in it. And I think the previous cycle, you know, it was all driven by that you know, when it last peaked around sort of 3 or 4 years ago. It was all like proper retail mania, wasn't it? Everyone was going mad for Bitcoin. As you say, it was not backed by anything. And a lot of others couldn't invest. It was all very much the retail following. But, you know, what we're now seeing, I think, is a result of this sort of massive and steady inflow from effectively institutional investors, you know, the Black Rocks and that. The fact that you can go into it now, you know, with ETF demand, you know, and then there's also and the halving we've seen where those sort of rewards to Bitcoin are going to drop from that 6.25 Bitcoin to 3.125 Bitcoin, which, you know, we know that it happens every 4 years, and I think it's going to occur next month. So the fact that it's going to get even more difficult to mine these individual Bitcoins where the rewards drop for miners means demand's going to be higher and supply's going to be less. So it's driven up by that. So, you know, there's a couple of factors there. And I think it is very interesting watching the way it's going to move.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing is we talk about Bitcoin as if Bitcoin is also the only thing in there. And I mean, you do have literally thousands, if not tens of thousands of these, I don't know what the right word is, but rubbish
coins or Litecoins or whatever, you know, altcoins.
I was going to say that, you know, we talk about Bitcoin, but actually I see that the one that doesn't actually maybe get the headlines, that's got a chance, much better chance in my view than Bitcoin, is Ethereum, because Ethereum seems to have practical uses in the world as well, and has made a great effort to put itself forward for those practical uses. Now, I'm no expert, so don't question me on what all those uses are, but I know that they do have some practical uses, that they can be traded in a better way, that they can be used in different ways. So maybe, just maybe, that we'll all be talking about Ethereum and not Bitcoin in the future, because that will be the one that practically we can use in our life, I think. Whereas Bitcoin, not so much. It doesn't mean that it can't be, but not in the same way as Ethereum.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think if you look at like Ethereum and look at it sort of the graph compared to the Bitcoin rise of late, I think like Bitcoin has pulled all the attention recently, but actually Ether has not really reacted from you know, if you look at the graph. So I think it potentially could move in a similar trajectory, you know. And there's also been there's been talk of this Denken upgrade, and there's also this ETF application potentially being catalyst. So it's been overshadowed a bit by Bitcoin for sure over the last sort of several months, and I do wonder whether Ether may go from, you know, above 8,000, 10,000, and maybe even higher, and we may even see Ethereum hitting those all time as well.
Anyway, time will tell, and by no means are we an expert, so please take what we say with a pinch of salt, because there's many more people that know more about it than we do.
Yeah.
Certainly than I do, anyway. So, yeah, we will watch this space and see what happens. What I do know is that there are many, many resource plays out there that are significantly undervalued, both for what they have and what they will, in the end, either JV, sell, or produce. And, you know, these are the things that we physically need and are in demand. So either, as I said, those share prices need to catch up and fast, or the commodity prices themselves need to drop. And this, I think, is probably highly unlikely. But there we go.
All right. Well, I think we've talked long enough. I hope you've enjoyed the couple of guests we've had on. And obviously, they're both newcomers to the roast. And if you like what you've heard, please hit the subscribe icon and also the bell icon so you get any further notifications of any future episodes.
Indeed. Thanks for listening, guys and girls.
Have a good one.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.